Okay, so thank you, Lee, for this session, which is really very interesting and cross-disciplinary. Lee asked me around 10 days ago if I wanted to talk there, and I mindlessly said yes. And then last week I realized that I have to talk, and I wanted to talk about something new here, which is about these dots. Okay, so what are the questions I'm interested in? I always like to start with the questions there. The first question I would like to address ultimately is, is it possible to define the notion of entropy of gravitational system? And the reason it's a profound question was first noticed by Penrose is that if you look at the evolution of non-gravitational system, this is what they look like. Clumped to, this is what thermalization looks like, from low entropy to high entropy. Now, if we look at time evolution of gravitational system, they look like the exact opposite. So clearly, the notion of thermalization in a gravitational system is completely the opposite of the notion of thermalization without. And what we go from here, that we go from a state of low gravitational wave to a state of high gravitational waves. So what this suggests is that we could ultimately understand the notion of entropy production in a gravitational system as gravity wave production. But today, the notion of what is entropy when there's gravity around completely escapes us. Now, the second question I'm interested in here is that, can we have a proper and acceptable and nice notion of horizon? And by proper, I mean local and physical definition of horizon. So the notion we usually use for horizons are event horizons. The problem with event horizons is that they are teleological, which means that in order to define them, you need to refer to the end of time. And there could be an horizon passing between us, just right now, but we will not know between a billion years. Okay? One way, so you would say maybe I would not care about that. The reason I care about that is that they have even a more drastic problematic property is that horizons are thermodynamically unstable. One way to say that is that it's clear to see that the bulk viscosity of event horizon is negative. So horizons as thermodynamical systems do not satisfy the second law of thermodynamics. And the reason for that is that if I have an horizon here, and I look at, I just displace myself a little bit inside or outside, what's going to happen? Because it's an horizon, light rays are going to diverge. This is the peeling effects of horizons. And this light ray that diverge are responsible for this instability of horizons perturbation, which is essentially encoded into this negative bulk viscosity. So the way to make horizons stable is to ignore this bulk viscosity or to go to, let's say, a CFT setting, or we're going to see one other effect. So let's say this is why people have gone to try to define another notion of horizons, and one of the most popular, which is this time local, it's the notion of trapped horizon or dynamical horizons. The problem with these ones is that in a dynamical situation, trapped horizons or dynamical horizons are space-like objects. So they do not correspond to a physical object. So the third notion that I think is the most interesting in my view, which has been defined, is the notion of stretched horizon. These ones are local, they are time-like, but up to now, there is no proper mathematical definitions of them, and they are only approximately defined. So I would say there's no notion of a proper, gravitational surface up to now. So another question I'm interested in is, what is a proper definition of gravitational observer? We know by the equivalence principle that a single world line does not see any interesting geometry. So the only way to see interesting geometry is to have a notion of observer which is not point-like, but has a certain extension and is quasi-local. Then the question is, if the observer is quasi-local, what is the shape of the observer and how to define properly this notion of quasi-local observer? And finally, the question which is really the topic of this talk is, and this is related to these three questions, is there a correspondence between gravity and thermodynamics? So there seems to be lots of evidence between such a correspondence, although when you review the literature, most of this evidence is really correspondence between black hole physics and thermostatics, as was emphasized in the previous talks. And it's only very recently that people have started to look at the proper, you know, thermalization process and out of equilibrium process. And this is really what we're after. If you want to have a correspondence, the correspondence should be between should be valid in a context which is out of equilibrium. There is one context which was referred to in the previous talk where somehow the previous problem about instability of the black hole has been resolved is in the context of ADS fluid gravity correspondence. And this is the idea by Minwala and collaborator. Here, the way it works physically is that, let's say, you consider a large black hole in ADS, which is sitting here. And the property of ADS is that it's a reflective boundary. So if you send some light rays from the black hole, it's going to go to the boundary and come back. What it does is that it defines some time length scale or time scale on the boundary, on the black hole horizon or on the boundary. And this time scale, you can consider it as being the mean free path of your system. And then you can look for perturbation whose wavelength is really way larger than this mean free path. In that case, you know, of course, you have this black hole instability, but it goes to infinity, it comes back, and it averages itself out. And this is a context which is this hydrodynamical limit in which you can describe gravity in this black hole physics in a stable context. But this is really in this hydrodynamical limit where this number called the Knudsen number, which is the ratio of the mean free path over your black hole scale, is just smaller than one. And in that context, the fluid is really at infinity. So this correspondence is really dynamical and leads to lots of interesting physics, but it's very highly non-local. And the reason it works is because you do address these questions of instability using this hydrodynamical limit. Okay, so here I would like to investigate the possibility to have such a correspondence between gravity and thermodynamics, but which is not so non-local and which might hold quasi-locally. And the main reason that such a correspondence could be possible goes back to the membrane paradigm idea, which is a very, very beautiful idea in physics. But up to now, it's always treated as some kind of toy model. And we would like to extend this membrane paradigm idea beyond the realm of being just a toy model in certain situations, but towards being a full-fledged correspondence. And the key in order to do that is to understand the mechanism of entropy production, that is relaxation towards equilibrium, as all of the speakers today were talking about. So I'm going to review, because it's supposed to be introductory, some aspects of non-equilibrium thermodynamics, the membrane paradigms, and I'm going to talk about constitutive law for the gravitational screens. So let's start with relativistic hydrodynamics. If we consider a relativistic fluid, it's characterized by its velocity. If there's a conserved charge, there's going to be a particle current density. Then there is the entropy density and the thermal energy momentum tensor. If somebody has a pointer that works, that would be very, very useful. Nobody in the audience? Okay. And the conservation law, and there is, you know, the laws of the physics of relativistic hydrodynamics are essentially charge conservation, energy momentum conservation, and the second law, which is that the entropy production is always positive. Now, for an ideal fluid, we assume, you know, local thermal equilibrium. So in kinetic theory, this will be a limit where somehow the collision time is way, 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 way smaller than the macroscopical time scale, and things equilibrate very rapidly. At equilibrium, the definition is that all the currents are aligned with the velocity of the fluid. Okay, so there's no transverse flux. And so we have the entropy at equilibrium, the E means equilibrium here. And this data, the entropy current is characterized by the velocity and the entropy density. There's also a charge density. And then the equilibrium tensor, energy momentum tensor, depends only on the internal energy and the pressure, the thermostatic pressure. Okay, and here, in this decomposition, we decompose things in terms of parallel to the velocity and transverse, the transverse metric. Now, to close the system, we need to provide an equations of state, which is essentially, you know, what is the value of the entropy functional in terms of E and N. And the first law translate into two equations. One is which is the Gibbs relation that defines what the temperature and the chemical potential is. And the second one is the Euler relation that defines what the pressure, thermostatic pressure is. OK, so this is a review. Now, you know, when you do dynamics, you need to split the derivative into a convective derivative along the flow, which is denoted by dot here, and the transverse derivative. And the equations have this very simple form here, where we see that essentially the enthalpy, E plus P, plays the role of the mass, the relativistic mass. Okay. Now, you know, if we can take these equations plus the equations of state, we have a total of D plus four equations for D plus four quantities. So, you know, things close off and we can analyze the system. And to simplify the exposition, I'm going to now assume to go to the viscous case that there's no conserved charge. In that case, the equations of states are very simple, just a function, the energy is just a function of the entropy and the temperature and the pressure are just given like that. Okay, so for out of equilibrium, what do? We take, let's say, in the kinetic framework, we take the phase space distribution and we split it into an equilibrium phase space distribution and then a viscous phase space distribution. And similarly for all the currents here. So the energy momentum tensor, which is the thermal energy momentum tensor, divides itself into the equilibrium one and the viscous one. And a priori, it's characterized by a different quantity. There's a viscous internal energy. There's a vector here, which is the heat flow vector. So the momenta of this tensor is the flow of heat. And then there's a viscous pressure, and there's a viscous shear. This object, this is a tensor which is transverse and traceless here. Now, in order to define the theory, in a relativistic system, there's a difficulty about what you call velocity. So here we're going to call to work in what's called the Landau frame. This is the frame where you say that velocity is defined by the flow of energy. So in this frame, you can assume that the heat flux vanish. And there's also something which is still under debate, which is the fact that you can always also assume that the internal viscous energy vanish. And this can be done by redefining your notion of temperature. So there will be out of equilibrium corrections to what temperature is. It's proven in first order thermodynamics. It's not proven in full generality. So this is still in debate. So in that framework, you know, Landau frame, no conserved charge, and in this Landau frame, the viscous stress tensor is characterized by the viscous pressure and the shear stress. And that's all, okay? And now the equations of motions have this generalized form where there's a contribution, viscous contribution to the enthalpy here, and then there's an extra contribution to the viscous force. And the evolution of the internal energy also contains contribution from viscous force, which are going to be responsible for entropy production. So this term pi and pi sigma. And here a new term appears, which is that we look at the gradient, the transverse gradient of the velocity flow, which is called the shear strain. And up to now here, the notation is that I was using theta. It's the divergence of the velocity vector. It's the expansion rate that governs how fast the fluid is expanding. So all of that is very standard. But you know, once we include viscosity, the system now becomes incomplete because we have had extra variable, which has this viscous pressure and viscous shear. So we need extra equations to complete the systems. And these are the constitutive equations that define the nature of the fluid you're talking about, whether it's water or some type of other fluid. And these are essentially the general constitutive equations are any relationship that defines the stress, the thermodynamical forces in terms of the flux. So here the pressure in terms of the expansion factor or the shear stress in terms of the shear velocity of the rate of strain. And now these constitutive relations have to be carefully designed in order to satisfy the principle of the second law. And that's a non-trivial requirement. Okay. So now these constitutive relations have to be given and have to be in agreement with two fundamental principles. First, the principle of relativity, and then the principle of the second law. So they have to be causal. They have to satisfy the second law. They also have a third principle to be stable. And remarkably, it has been extremely challenging to combine these two principle, or this string principle. And in fact, it started, relativistic hydrodynamics maybe started with Eckhart around 60 or 70 years ago, but up to yesterday, it's still the questions of how you really write proper constitutive equations for relativistic fluid is still in debate and still moving. And lots has been happening recently because of the development to do RIG data and also ADS-CFT correspondence. But before I'm going to explain how to settle this, this issue, I want to talk about what the relationship is with gravity. Okay, so let me change gear, because so far it was really purely relativistic thermodynamic. So now I'm changing gear and I'm looking at another system. I want to look at 3 plus 1 gravity to set up, to fix the ideas. And we would like to provide a quasi-local description of gravitational physics without having to refer to the end of time, like in black hole horizons, or to the end of space, like in ADS-CFT. But let's say, suppose we have a laboratory in this room, and we want to set up, you know, what happens to the physics in this room. So this means that we define a domain, which is the inside of this room, and the boundary of this domain, which is this boundary of this room, which will be, we'll call the gravitational screen here. And the time evolution of this gravitational screen is assumed to be a time-like surface, which evolved in space-time in that manner drawn here. And in some sense, this gravitational screen is what I would call a generalized gravitational observer, if you want. And the question is that we're interested in is, what is the gravitational dynamics of the bulk region, the region inside, from the point of view of the screen? There's a general principle at play here, which is local holography, that essentially implies that in a gravitational system, you will always be able to project the equations of motions on your gravitational screen. But I'm not going to explain that. So what I'm going to focus on is essentially the punchline. The punchline is that this gravitational dynamics of this region inside the screen can be encoded into the screen boundary, essentially in terms of a time-dependent two-dimensional metric. So my screen is a two-dimensional surface, and a two-dimensional relativistic fluid on this two-dimensional boundary. Okay, so, and this goes back to, this idea goes back to the Damour, Price, and Thorne in the membrane paradigm. So how does that work? So let me try to explain what is the membrane paradigm idea in a few lines. The key idea of the membrane paradigm is that suppose we have a region here and we divide the space-time into inside and out. And the key idea of the membrane paradigm is that we can replace this full space-time arbitrarily divided here by, for an outside observer, an observer that will never enter inside, this picture is, as far as he's concerned, is equivalent to a picture where he stays outside, and instead of imagining that there's something inside the box or inside the screen, he just imagined that there's a relativistic fluid along the screen, and this relativistic fluid is characterized by, you know, what is the metric of this gravitational screen, what is the velocity flow, and what is the viscous energy momentum tensor there. And as far as outside observer is concerned, the description is fully equivalent. That's the membrane paradigm idea. The realization comes from essentially a generalization of Israel junction condition, which state that if you take a metric and you create a shell discontinuity in a space-time metric, this shell discontinuity will never affect the Weyl tensor. It will only affect the Einstein tensor. So we can decompose the full Einstein tensor in terms of the inside part, G plus, sum of the inside part and the outside part. And the external observer interacts only with the outside Einstein tensor. And therefore, this outside Einstein tensor has a part which is a bulk part and a part which comes from the boundary. And the part which comes from the boundary defines the stress tensor on the boundary. So the screen possesses a stress tensor. It means that it possesses internal pressure, it possesses internal energy, it possesses all the qualities that a relativistic fluid does possess. So this is the picture we are interested in. Now, if no matter flow, for simplicity, I'm going to talk about the fact that, you know, at the moment of time locally, no matter flow is present, the gravitational screen is conserved. here. So we are exactly in the context of relativistic hydrodynamics. If there is some matter outflow that enters or leave the screen, then there will be an extra contribution on the right-hand side, which is proportional to the flow of matter on the direction which is radial to the screen. In the following, this so on the screen, I do have two directions. One is this time-like velocity, u, and the other one is a radial velocity of embedding in the space-time. But now I'm going to take the point of view of the fluid. That is, I'm going to sit inside this screen. And from the point of view of the fluid, S, you know, there's no extra direction there. So we are going to see how this extra direction appears somehow from the relativistic description, the relativistic fluid description. So here, okay, it's a bit bulky. What I want to show you is that if you work out this correspondence, there's a very precise correspondence between what is the thermodynamical quantities I've described to you in the beginning, so the thermostatic pressure, the internal energy, the rate of strain, which is just the gradient of velocity, the viscous stress that is responsible for the force, and the heat flow. And they all have a specific correspondence in the gravitational setting. I'm not going to explain too much. Maybe let me focus that the thermostatic pressure is essentially the radial acceleration of the screen. So you look at how the screen, you know, embedded in space-time accelerates away from itself. The internal energy is proportional to the radial expansion. Okay, there's no precisely physical reason why it should be that. I cannot give you one here. I could, but it would take me longer to explain you why. Now, the rate of strain is the same thing. It's the temporal shear, so there's no change here. What's interesting is that the viscous stress now makes reference to this imaginary radial direction, and essentially the viscous stress becomes just the radial shear. Okay, so this is how somehow relativity encodes these two different notions of flux and force that are present in thermodynamics. One is a flow along time-like direction. The other is a flow around a radial direction. OK, so now let's go back to the problem of entropy production. The main issue in entropy production is to understand and to find out what is the entropy current. And in order to define this entropy current, we need to organize a notion in thermodynamics, you need to have a notion of expansion around equilibrium. Okay, so you need a small parameter. The thing which is most of the time ignored or not precisely understood enough is that in thermodynamics, there's not one expansion parameter, but there's two expansion parameters. One is an expansion parameter which is called the Knudsen number, which is essentially saying that what is the ratio of the mean free path versus the large length scale. Okay? And this is the one that is used in this, that we made the reference to in this ADS-CFT correspondence. Everything is made in expansion in this Knudsen number, and in ADS you have a preferred scale that defines for you this mean free path scale. Then the other expansion number is called the inverse Rayleigh number, or Reynolds number, which is essentially the ratio of viscosity divided by non-viscous object, internal energy or pressure. Okay? So in a non-relativistic system, at long time, when things have settled down, these two parameters are effectively related in Navier-Stokes equations. You know, they are related. They're essentially given by the ratio of velocity of the fluid versus the speed of sound. Okay, but if you're in a transient, a very dynamical system, these are not the same scale. They are related, one constrains the other, but they are very, very different scale of expansion. And this is the key idea. The key idea is that clearly, you know, when we do local dynamics, we cannot do what Minwala did. We don't have a mean free path scale that is set up there. But we do have another scale, which is this viscosity scale. And this is the one we are going to use. So the idea is we're going to use. So the main point here is that there's two types of the, you know, expansion you can do in hydrodynamics. One is a low viscosity expansion. The other one is a derivative expansion. And they are not the same when it concerns constitutive relations. Okay, so what about the second law? So now we proceed with the law of viscosity. So the key idea is that we are going to take the expansion not in terms of derivative, but expansion in terms of low viscosity. So at first order, so now we can organize, you know, the calculations in terms of zeroth order. So zeroth order is equilibrium. First order, it's called local equilibrium. It's called classical thermodynamics. And this is what you would find in 99% of the books, okay? And essentially what you postulate is that at first order, you postulate that the entropy in the longer gauge is essentially just given by the equilibrium entropy current, okay? So this is the condition of local equilibrium, that every particle of fluid has equilibrated there. Now, you can compute from there what is the entropy production under the assumption of local equilibrium, and you find that this is essentially the contraction of the shear stress times the viscosity, the velocity stress, and then the pressure, the viscous pressure times the rate of expansion. And if you demand that this object is always positive, the only way to achieve that is essentially to demand that the viscous pressure is proportional to the rate of expansion and the viscous stress is proportional to the rate of strain. And these proportional coefficients are defines the viscosity. There is two viscosity, the bulk viscosity, the one concerning this object, and the shear viscosity, and the entropy production has this generalized second order form, which is essentially a square of viscous pressure tensors. Okay, and in the black hole case, if you do these things, what you find for this object, you find a minus sign here. This is what I was made reference to. So in the black hole case, let's say in flat space time, you know, you don't have the second law being satisfied for general configuration. Now, this has been the status quo for a very long time, but what came up more recently is that, in fact, these equations are not satisfactory. So they lead to, they violate the principle of relativity. Essentially, they lead to acausal signaling. So if you assume, and it makes perfect sense, because here, what you're demanding, when you're demanding that this force is proportional to the velocity gradients, is that you demand that there is, or this hypothesis of local equilibrium demands that there is no time scale for which things equilibrate. So it's instantaneous equilibration. And that violates the principle of relativity. Even more seriously than that, it leads to instabilities as shown by Hitchcock and Lindblom. So this has triggered the search for a more general way, more consistent way of writing the second law of thermodynamics in relativistic fluid. So what we just established is that if you want to really have satisfactory relativistic constitutive law, a law of entropy or relaxations toward equilibrium, you need to have a relaxation time appearing in the equations. And in fact, you need to be as we saw that the entropy production current is quadratic in this Rayleigh number. It's quadratic in the viscosities, whereas the local equilibrium truncates it to be linear in the viscosity. So this truncation is inconsistent. To have a consistent truncation, you need to assume that the entropy current is also quadratic in the viscosity. So the most general form for the entropy current is going to be of this form. So you start that the entropy current has the local equilibrium form. But of course, there's going to be, you know, higher order corrections coming from the non-equilibrium dynamics of the fluid. And the first one you can write is essentially, you know, that one is proportional to the square of the viscous pressure, and the other one is proportional to the square of the stress, okay, with arbitrary coefficients here. Better be positive if you want this local equilibrium to be a local maximum, but okay. Now, what you can check is that the imposition of positivity of the entropy production can still be done introducing only just one bulk viscosity and one shear viscosity, and the entropy production term has exactly the same form it had before in the first order. So the form of the entropy production is still just a perfect square with characterized by its two viscosity. So now what's changing is the type of constitutive relations we are going to have between these objects. And this has a long and winding and painful histories, and there are many, many different versions. Here I'm giving you the end point. By asking this question, I realized that there was a term missing that most people just neglect or forget to put, which reappeared in this analysis. And this term was necessary to make the correspondence with gravity. So it's one example where, by asking a gravity question and wondering why the usual books do not give you the right answer, you finally come up with the right answer, which you could have figured out purely in the relativistic hydro setting. So the constitutive relations now have a more complex form, which has a form of a relaxation equation. So there is a time scale that appears here, tau, which is the relaxation time, which is a ratio of the viscosity over the temperature times this factor we put in the entropy current there. Then there's an extra time that couples to the expansion. There's a third time, which is just the viscosity response. And then there's a fourth term here, which is a coupling between shear and stress. And this is a term that usually never appears in none of the analysis. It's only the first reference where it appears was in a kinetic theory analysis of a few months ago, but not in this generalized setting. And then there's an extra term here. So the cut coloring means that if you decide to expand, and you can check that all these terms are really a first order in the Rayleigh number, in the inverse Rayleigh number. You know, this is linear in viscosity, linear in viscosity, linear in viscosity, linear in viscosity, linear in viscosity. Okay. But if you assume, as it was, it's usually done, that somehow viscosity is the same order as the Knudsen number, then you have to neglect this term, because this term now is linear in viscosity, but also linear in time derivative. So you have to drop it, and you have to drop, in this coefficient, there's a term here which is dropped. So let's say standard hydrodynamic drop these terms, and this term usually does not appear. And then you have a simple model of relaxation. If these terms are not there, essentially you see that, you know, you have to use your imagination, but you see that essentially it's an equation that says that I'm going to have an exponential relaxation towards, you know, the usual non-relativistic relation, and then after that, it's good. But in the general context, I'm going to have coupling of this relaxation time to the bulk viscosity and the shear viscosity, and that's going to be very important for my gravitational screen. Okay, and we can do the same for shear stress by putting more indices. Okay, so this is the gist of, and this is the end point of, what I'm saying is that this is the final equations of relaxation, second law for relativistic. Now, that contains all the possible terms you can put at the consistent truncation. Okay? And for some reason, it was never done properly before. So now what's remarkable and where our story winds up is the fact that, okay, now I say that when I have my gravitational screen, I have a fluid there. But a priori, I could put my gravitational screen more where, you know, it was anywhere in space and in space-time. I could place it anywhere in space-time. By changing the way I place it in space-time, I'm changing the constitutive relation. I'm changing the way the radial position depends on the time position, right? And this is exactly what the constitutive relationship is. So most of these screens will not be physical screens. They will not satisfy the second law of thermodynamics. So the question is now, well, is it possible within this membrane paradigm ID to have gravitational screens that are physical in the sense that they do satisfy a viscous, you know, relaxation towards equilibrium? And the answer is that remarkably, yes. That is, there exists a choice. So one of these equations, the tension here is that one of the equations in GR constrained the form of time evolution of what the viscous pressure here is. If you remember, and presumably you don't at this stage, the viscous stress is related to this radial shear here. So it's related to the derivative, the radial derivative of the tangential derivative of the radial normal. Okay. So in gravity, there's one equation that constrains that, which is essentially one of the Einstein equations. This is the equations that constrain the flow of energy along the screen. Okay. And what's remarkable is that there is a choice of constitutive relation which exactly gives the same Einstein equation. What that means is that it's possible to have a choice of constitutive equations that satisfy the second law, which is, in fact, consistent with the idea that this screen, this membrane paradigm screen, is coming from gravity. And here I outlined for you what essentially it entails, is that the shear bulk coupling has to be related to the relaxation time scale. And this is why I need a shear bulk coupling that was not there before. And then the gamma was the radial acceleration of the screen. So essentially, we see that the radiation acceleration of the screen is related to the viscosity, the bulk viscosity, which is now positive. And then there are other conditions. Now, this is the bulk. So the bulk constitutive equations is compatible with Einstein equations. There's another constitutive equation, which is the one for the shear. And we can look at what is the shear constitutive equations. And the shear constitutive equation essentially determines the rate of, so it shows that determines the rate of gravitational waves falling inside your screen. And so if you want to have a gravitational screen which is physical, what it says is that you have to place it in space-time in such a way that this rate is always of the proper form. And the proper form is that essentially this rate of falling of gravitational wave is controlled by one, this component of the Weyl tensor. So omega S, A, U, B is a component of the Weyl tensor along the direction S, A, U, and B. Okay, and that controls how much gravitational weight per unit time goes inside. And it turns out that the viscosity relation or the second law satisfies if this tensor has this form. Okay. And that somehow determines for you what would be a thermodynamical screen that you could put in space-time and somehow now study for its own sake. Okay, so I think I'm done. I'm at my conclusion. What we have seen is that there exists a profound correspondence between gravity and non-equilibrium thermodynamics. And this correspondence is really by developing a full-fledged implementations of the membrane paradigm ID. Now, according to this idea, a gravitational screen carries a viscous relativistic fluid. And the key idea, in order to describe quasi-local screen, is to use not the Knudsen expansion, but to use the Rayleigh, inverse Rayleigh expansion here. So instead of using a low derivative expansion, we use a low viscosity expansion. And in fact, this is very different because it leads to very different truncations of the constitutive relation. And that has to be appreciated. Very different way of relaxing towards equilibrium. And that does matter for this exact implementation of this correspondence. And in that manner, it's very different from gravity fluid because in the gravity fluid, you don't do a low viscosity expansion, you do a low derivative expansion. So it's kind of the inverse, the opposite. ID, in some sense. Now, remarkably, as I said, the truncation of the second law to second order is perfectly consistent with GR. So gravity, in that sense, appears as a low viscosity expansion of a real fluid. And in that sense, Einstein GR looks like some near equilibrium situation. So it suggests that higher derivative corrections of gravity, you know, will correspond or might correspond to higher viscous corrections to hydrodynamics, and that the full quantum gravity, if it really holds up, you know, corresponds to full statistical mechanics. So this is somehow, you know, establishing these ideas on firm ground will give you a new way to think about how to deform gravity into something which is more akin to quantum gravity. And then the last question is that, is this useful? And I don't know yet, but I hope at some point we'll interact with Luis, and I hope that this generalized boundary condition, because you can take them as that, like stable generalized boundary condition could be used in numerical codes to maybe, you know, evolve them locally, but I don't know. Thank you.
Five minutes for questions, discussions, and then we'll have a panel. So I know that was very quick. The last time Laurent gave a talk about this, it was 2.5 hours.
I can ask a question. Oh, Bhaskar.
When you say correction to gravity theory, is it still respecting Einstein's covariance principles and so on, or?
Yeah, it would be. So yeah. So that's the idea. What I'm saying is that here we've established that there is a correspondence between Einstein gravity and second order hydrodynamics. But in hydrodynamics, there's no preferred reason to stop at second order, right? A priori, this is just an approximation of a more realistic fundamental kinetic theory or statistical mechanical theory. So you know, the hydro picture says, well, you know, you should have a natural expansion. So then
still respecting.
Well, the question is whether you could continue this correspondence, putting higher derivative theory and have this correspondence that respect the second law principle, whether that works at the second order. But for that, you will have to go beyond Einstein gravity. You will have to have higher derivative correction to Einstein gravity. And I don't know. Here at play is something which I don't fully understand, is that somehow there's a choice of constitutive relations which mysteriously reestablish the space-time covariance, right? The space-time covariance is absolutely not obvious from the hydrodynamical picture. And that's somehow what's kind of mysterious here. So to answer your question, we will have to, you know, if that's really possible, what it means is that there is secretly in hydrodynamics some kind of underlying symmetry group that relates the constitutive coefficients. And when they are related in that way, you could say, well, the theory could be embedded as a space-time theory. And when they are not, it's just pure hydro. Okay? But that's such a symmetry has never been. It would be very weird to look for a space-time symmetry from the point of view of hydro. So, you know, nobody has really looked for it. I think it's related to this deep problem that people have started to talk about, which is this problem of velocity. You know, here I've described everything in the Landau frame, and because this is the simplest, but there's the questions of equivalence of hydrodynamical description in different frames, which is a very related question.
Okay. So is there one more question?
So I can, oh, there's Rafael, okay. Okay, so whenever, I mean, whatever arbitrary surface that you define in a space-time, you can find its extrinsic curvature, and then define Brownian-Yorke stress tensor, which is conserved if Einstein equations are satisfied. So then the question is, it seems that you want to put a particular constraint on the form of this stress tensor, that it looks like a perfect fluid or almost a perfect fluid up to...
No, not almost a perfect fluid. What I want to find is the constraints that make this fluid physical. That is, I want this fluid to satisfy the second law. So most of the time, when you place a surface in space-time, there is a fluid, it satisfies the fluid equations of motion, but it violates the second law. So what I was looking for is that I'm saying there's a very particular way of placing this thing in space-time that respects the second law. And the constitutive relation is exactly a relationship between the intrinsic geometry and the extrinsic geometry.
But don't you need to know the temperature to be able to define the second law? Because,
So it's as an expansion around this.
And Rafael, did you want to?
I mean, there's a pressure. Yeah, there's a. Yeah. Yes. So okay. You need to postulate an equation of state.
And I'm just saying, you didn't say anything about temperature.
No, I did not. I didn't have time to talk about the equilibrium state here. I focused on the constitutive relation. It would be a talk by itself somehow. But there is, I mean, it appears here. There's some of the constitutive relations, let's say, it's kind of hidden here that here, you see, there's a relationship between the time scale, this relationship here. There's a relationship between the time scale, the radial acceleration, and the viscosity. And the time scale, you know, is defined as essentially the inverse temperature. So that gives you a relationship between the temperature and the radial acceleration, which is in agreement with kind of usual general picture, but here it's more precise because you need really the viscosity.
Does it somehow match the black hole?
Well, the black hole will be a limit where the tension, the pressure goes to infinity. So in some sense, the black hole is a very singular limit because it's a null surface. Okay, here I'm talking about physical systems. And as I was saying, the black hole naively is not, it's not thermodynamically stable. So it would be interesting to see how you could, how does it survive the limit? This limit might be, in this limit, this temperature that appears here will go to infinity in some sense, because this is really the temperature that an accelerated observer static at the, at a certain distance of the black hole experience. So if you go closer, there will not be the black hole temperature. There's going to be a redshifting factor.
Okay, last question, quick. I know I keep doing this to you, Raphael.
I mean, I'm happy to just do it privately if you think that's better.
Yeah.
Okay. Which is the prelude to what would be a long question. So why don't we thank Laurent?